Hello, and welcome to The Runs, the podcast in which we talk about runs of comic books. This week, we'll be talking about Jonah and Vasquez's series Squee with world-famous cartoonist Julia Graffaire. Julia Graffaire
is... That's me.
That's you. Julia Graffaire is a...
world-famous.
You are. I had to speak to many representatives to get you on the show. I'll do your intro. Brilliant comics creator. You've done books such as Laid Waste and Black is the Color, both published by Fantagraphics. You've had stories published in the Best American Comics Anthology, Kramer's Ergo, Study Group Magazine, Cicada Magazine, and many others. You've got like a nice thin line. You do sort of mythical stories. Does that sound like a good summary? Your work is very hard to summarize.
Yeah, I think it's not necessarily mythical, but usually there's like a supernatural element to it. Though I think not always. Like I did a comic for the Flash Forward anthology. This is a podcast about the future or whatever. And then they did an anthology. And my piece for that was about AI, art created by AI. I did this about a year and a half ago, so I was well ahead of the curve. My contribution to the discourse was ready in advance. And there's nothing supernatural in that one except for the possibility that an AI could care about art, which I guess the one in my comic kind of seems to. Sometimes they're pretty mundane. They're almost always, I think they could always make sense if you remove the supernatural element and people are just responding to ordinary pressure. Even in Laid Waste, it's not really magical. The woman in it, Agnes, it takes place during the bubonic plague, and she can't seem to catch the plague while everyone around her dies. And she thinks it's for a supernatural reason, but it's not necessarily. Maybe she's immune. I don't know if that's possible.
She feels left out of the plague.
Right?
And then do you ink with a nib?
No, I use a rapidograph, 0.35.
Oh, how do you get those to work? I've never been able to get those to work. You have to hold them at like a really specific angle.
You do. You have to hold it almost perpendicular to the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't draw fast. Mm-hmm. You can't draw. You do kind of have to get the hang of it. But I really like it because since it's a drafting pen, so it's designed for drawing diagrams and things like that. So the line width that you get is very, very consistent. So it's a great upgrade for people who cut their teeth on microns that have that nice, dark, fine line. But then when you start, a fresh micron looks so nice and smooth and dark. Then when it gets to about middle age, it starts to get a little crunchy. That will never happen with a rapidograph. Rapidograph, the line looks the same always. So it feels different in your hand, but the line is similar. So if you like that type of line, that's what I always recommend. But it does take a little getting used to get the line to flow the way that you want. And also you have to be pretty responsible about cleaning it, or else it will act up. It's like a bad dog.
It's a bad dog of a pen. It gets perfect line consistency, but hard to take care of. Yeah, they seemed high.
It's like you share it with your friend, and you have to be like, "Oh, he never acts like this at home."
Yeah. Yeah, I just could never get them to work. I was so excited about them, and then I tried. I don't understand this tool.
You use a brush, right? Or you probably do digital like everybody now.
No, I've been penciling digital, which I have mixed feelings about, but it's so helpful for scooting things around and creating perspective grids for backgrounds and stuff. I find very helpful.
Ooh, yeah.
But I print the pencils on Bristol and I ink on paper because I don't understand why anyone would ever ink with digitally. I get the lines I want digitally and I don't like the feeling. So yeah, I'm mostly brushes and then some little nibby nib and then the Pitt pen. I like that guy a lot because it lasts longer. It's more reliable. Microns are, I letter with microns, but you get like half an hour out of a micron and then they start.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You got to make friends with that rapidograph.
I'll think about it. Maybe for lettering, it would be smart. Yeah, I'll just think about it. I'll get back to you.
So I got to know though, when you're printing out those pencils, just on your home printer, you're putting Bristol through your home printer?
Yeah, I have like a big crappy printer scanner combo and it has a tray in the back and you can just stick. Yeah, and I just print them blue or I've been doing them red because my blue clogged up.
Cool.
Yeah, and just as light as possible, you know, so when you scan, you can just remove the color. But, you know, there's always cleanup.
Yeah, I don't know if this is getting way too far into the weeds for your listeners or if they like to hear about this kind of shit.
I don't know what listeners, there's a bunch of grown up goth kids right now, like get to the.
They want to hear about the comics.
Yeah, but just to get out of the weeds, I was trying to say how we know each other, me and the guest, to find a relationship. We're in Portland in like the early 2000s is how we know each other.
Yeah, right? I feel like we've known each other for like a really long time, but I couldn't say, it's not like we've ever really hung out one-on-one. We just always like run into each other at places and chat. I don't know.
I think we're in the same scene. And then you've been gone a long time, right?
Well, yeah, I've been living in New York since 2015.
Okay.
But I have a little bit of a parasocial relationship with you because I was a huge fan of your Saved by the Bell podcast.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
No, yes, you did because I feel like I've told you that before.
Oh, maybe I forgot.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, man, that podcast got me through some hard times. Your Saved by the Bell podcast and History of Rome podcast were the two podcasts that I first listened to regularly. So it's a real kind of a high-low culture contrast there.
Yeah, Saved by the Bell is high culture. That's fair.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Yeah, I'm surprised we never had you on. And when I first ever was podcasting, it was for the Trip City website that Dean Haspiel was doing. And it was one-on-one interviews. And I think you were the next person that I was going to have on. And then they stopped doing it. I remember that. We were at like White Owl Social Club or something. And I was like, hey, we should have you on the show. And you're like, yeah. And then the podcast ended. So, but anyway, yeah, we're just familiar. We've just been in the same world for a long time but this also might be the longest conversation we've ever had. So both those things are true.
That's possible. I would have liked if we could hang out at SPX. We just didn't get a chance.
Yeah, I know. We just saw you at SPX and I had to really bug you to do this and I got some support, which was helpful. I was really excited about you doing this. And I love what you picked based on your own body of work and stuff. And then, yeah, I don't know. It goes so fast. And like, I only would see you when I was leaving. Like I would be okay, I'm calling and I'm going. And then I would be saying bye to people and you were there then. I saw you and I never saw you on the floor, although I was not on the floor very much.
That's how it goes with big conventions, though. You run into people that you like were not expecting to hang out with and the people that you wanted to talk to, you never see them.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it like I really wanted to hang out with Nicole Georges during the show. And I saw her like in the last 10 minutes of the show. She was like, I got to go. I got a train to catch. I was like, no.
Yeah.
It's always like that.
That's how it goes. Anyway, so we're going to be talking about Squee by Joan Vasquez. I'll do a real quick summary. It's his follow-up to his smash hit Johnny the Homicidal Maniac series published by Slave Labor, which was kind of the start of this big trend of goth comics in the 90s. These ran from 1997 to 1998, and these sold like crazy, right? Yes.
I don't really know like what the wider cultural context of it is, but I chose this one because this was the first, I think probably the first indie comic that I ever encountered. and chose for myself. You know, I read comics like what my parents had lying around. My dad really liked Zippy the Pinhead. So like weird comics were not strange to me necessarily, but nothing that was seemed like it was for me instead of for that, you know, previous generation or whatever. You know, I read newspaper comics. I read Cricket Magazine, always had comics, whatever, kid stuff. So I would have first read this in 1997 when I was 14. And it was at Hot Topic.
Yep.
And you laugh, but that was a big deal. Like,
no, I know. No,
for me, I grew up in Concord, New Hampshire, which is obviously a bustling hub of culture now. Sure. But at that time, there was a limit to what you'd have access to. This is before the internet was super widespread. I was online a little bit, but, you know, like on AOL or whatever. And I had access to the kind of freak culture that my parents, who were counterculture people from the 60s and 70s and 80s, you know, I had access to that, but anything that belonged to like my contemporary generation, I didn't really know about. So getting to go to the mall, the big mall, not the mall in Concord, the Steeplegate Mall, which may not have even been open when I was 15, I'm not sure. But the big mall in Salem, New Hampshire, that had a Hot Topic. And that's like at least an hour drive away. So that was a real expedition. That was a treat, maybe a couple times a year.
Yeah. Did you buy those really big jeans?
No, I did not have the big jeans. I remember like encountering Hot Topic for the first time. I was like, oh my gosh, like there's so much. I felt it was just very exciting to be in a place where you could actually participate in the kind of stuff that you, I don't know, it sounds so silly. It is essentially like a very consumerist perspective on culture, right? Because what I'm saying is, oh, when I could go to a store, that's when I was allowed to be part of the conversation, when I could buy the item that represented the culture.
Well, I think you're saying too, like, because I think you're right that these comics were, I think, about exactly the same age. These comics are very much our generation's sort of counterculture encapsulation comics, like a really specific moment of like mid to late 90s weird kids. This is like what that felt like in a lot of ways.
Hot Topic still exists now, and it's very, you know, the vibe is still goth and weird. But even the concept of goth and weird has become much more mainstream, like nerd culture.
Yes. You know? Oh, yeah. But what
when
I'm saying,
we were 15, it was weird to be into like Star Wars. That was still weird to be into. Now it is not weird. It's very mainstream. And goth culture is the same way. I'm sorry. Please finish your thought.
Oh, that's okay. And also, though, like our parents went to like head shops and bought Crumb comics.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It was like a head
like
shop.
Hole in the walls. And we went to the mall and bought this very like product oriented, crafted counterculture of these big pants and these like plastic black spiky shirts and stuff. Like it's just, there's a shift there, you know. But this series kind of perfectly hit that moment and that crossover of kids alone in their room being kind of mass marketed to.
I do still think that the Hot Topic of my youth was smaller and weirder than the Hot Topic now.
Probably.
I mean, I bought, this would have been maybe in 1998, I don't know, the Rasputina album, How We Quit the Forest.
Hell yeah. Uh-huh.
You know the album? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so I bought that at Hot Topic. Yep. And they gave me like a little necklace made out of Fimo. Like somebody handmade this fucker. They were like, oh yeah, everybody who buys this album gets this necklace.
Yeah.
I don't know who made it. I don't know if Melora Krieger made it or if some intern made it or what. But like, it was like a little clay heart with like a cursive R on it. And then it had like a ribbon that was like zigzag on the back, like it was a corset.
Uh-huh.
It was cute. I wonder if I still have it. But there was still, I think part of what was charming to me about Squee in particular, and also I did like, there's another slave labor comic, Roman Durge's Lenore.
Yep, which kind of gets like soft piloted at the end of this.
Yeah, I think there's a crossover, right? The one where she gets eaten by the little peeps.
Mm-hmm.
Is that they do have an imperfection to them.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it feel as if a person made it.
Yep. Yeah, there's a roughness for sure. There's even these, like, as polished as they are in some ways, there's also, like, a unprofessional quality at times, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was, even though I wasn't, like, connected to goth culture or even really punk culture very much directly, mm-hmm. I did have access to zines, and I was making zines at this time. And so it felt zine adjacent to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that made it something that was easier for me to understand.
So do you feel like these had an impact on your like, why I liked it so much that you picked this, I'll say my relationship with these comics too, but is because your work has a sophistication to it, you know, I would say. And then it made sense and was also hilarious to me. To go, oh, right. This is what you were impacted by these when you were 14, or like there's a logic.
Yeah. A child.
Know, yeah. And there's something so funny and great. And that we're the same age and like, oh, I totally remember this. So do you feel like there was something from these comics that you carried with you, like that's still present in some way?
I think a lot of things, reading them again to prepare for this podcast, I saw so many things that just sort of comics techniques and little emotional notes or ways of phrasing things that I feel like they kind of probably were really influential to me. One of the things that I noticed was that the concept of endurance is really big in these comics. Most, I think, straightforwardly in, I believe it's in issue 3, he talks about, he says, what if I made a movie that was deliberately the most difficult movie to watch?
Yeah.
And it would be, there's like a sex scene where the characters are vomiting on each other.
Mm-hmm.
The people in the movie theater are trying to get out and the doors are locked. The kids are screaming. Then it cuts to like a child being slowly chewed on by a monster, screaming for its mother. Like, it's really awful. And it's just like, and then he says, everybody would hate this movie, but then maybe 10 years later, it would become a cult classic. People would go to midnight movie screenings of it. And he says, you know, if I, as a filmmaker, had the power to make people physically uncomfortable with my movie, I would become as a god.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other stuff in the comics also that is just difficult to endure. Like there are a couple of them where Squee, should we explain the concept of the comic? I'll just briefly finish my thoughts. So where Squee meets a friend who is cute and friendly and then dies a horrible death that's very prolonged.
Mm-hmm.
there's something painful about the experience of reading the comic. Like, it's funny, but it's also difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I think I really liked that, and I still do. So Joan and Vesca's first series is Johnny the Homicidal Maniac, which is about a lovable serial killer in like tight pants with lots of buckles on them. And, you know, he like, it's kind of like a proto Jigsaw kind of an idea where like, he's so above it all. And he's really like sarcastic, and he's killing people who are stupid, and he tells them how stupid they are while he kills them. And his like, he's got like a lot of torture dungeons under his house and stuff, but it's also kind of poking fun at him for thinking that he's better than everybody. And I didn't really get into that one. I think I probably encountered Squee first, but there's more issues of that one, and it's better known. Squee is the spinoff, as you mentioned.
Yeah, it's like a follow up.
It's about Johnny's next door neighbor, who's a little boy. I don't think it specifies how old he is, probably younger than 8. I would say maybe 5. 5 or 6. His name is Todd, but his nickname is Squee, I think because he's scared a lot, and that's the noise that he makes when he's scared.
Oh, I was confused by that, because I just thought his name was Squee, and then I think around issue 3 or 4, they start calling him
Todd. Yeah, his parents call him Todd.
Yeah, and his parents are real mean and negligent.
Yeah, his dad just openly hates him, and his mother is a drug addict who can't really tell what's going on most of the time. But he has this teddy bear. The teddy bear is sentient and malevolent, but likes Todd and absorbs the trauma from the many horrible things that happened to him. So Todd retains his innocence and his sweetness, even though he has this next door neighbor who's a murderer, and his parents abuse him, and his best friend is the son of Satan, and he sees puppies get run over by cars constantly and things like that. Aliens threaten him with abduction. A lot of awful things happen to him, but the teddy bear, whose name is Shmee, not Squee, but Shmee. I don't know why that's the teddy bear's name. The teddy bear absorbs all of this darkness so that Squee can be free from trauma, which is interesting. So that's the premise. And then the comics are just like different episodes in Todd's life where terrible things happen to him. You know, I think probably a lot of the humor is related to, you know, watch this poor, adorable child be horribly abused.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much
different grotesque entities. His grandfather, like, chases him and gets injured, and he's, like, bleeding and drooling and chasing him and threatening to eat him. And
yeah, it's just
a little ghost shows up in his room and tells him to kill himself. I could go on.
Yeah, it's just very unpleasant. It's like
it is aggressively unpleasant.
Yeah.
Was that your main impression of it? Looking at it now, you were just like, this is awful.
Well, so I have a whole relationship with these comics too. I never read these. So I worked at the comic book store when I was in high school. It was a big formative identity thing for me. And I think about this a lot. Like, I went to Berkeley High, and I was in middle school, and I was different than all my friends, and I was obsessed with comics. And then you go to high school, and there was the park across the street where all the like weird kids hung out, you know? So I was like,
yeah, for us, it was the Cumberland Farms.
Yep. Yeah. So like hippies, and there were goth kids, and yeah. And I had a goth girlfriend in high school, which was like my big advice to high school kids before it became redundant, was if you're a nerd, you get yourself a goth girlfriend in high school, because they're basically just nerds with like a different style. Anyway, I worked at the comic store, and I was very into comics, and these were like the popular thing. Like, people who didn't really care about comics, who were alternative kids or whatever, these were hugely popular. And I checked them out and I just hated these comics. I thought that they were so bad. And like the
You were into mainstream comics, like superhero stuff? Or?
I was into a lot of different stuff, and I always have been, is kind of the thrust of this podcast. So I read some, you know, Marvel and DC comics, but I also read, I mean, at that time, what was I reading? Like I was really, really into the Max, was a huge one for me. And then, I don't know, like Tank Girl and Scud the Disposable Assassin and Sandman comics I read.
I mean, that's pretty alternative, all that stuff.
Yeah, no. And so it wasn't like on principle I didn't like these. It's like I gave them a chance and tried to read them. I don't like the like.
I think compared to those, it seems very low effort.
Yeah, well, and I don't like the like shouting random things to be funny. Like, yes. I've got cheese in my pants or whatever. Like, that shit is just not funny to me. And it also, I think for me, there was a piece of like, I went over across the street to the park when I got to the bigger school and was like, okay, these are the weird kids now. And sort of, this is a big dynamic of my life, feeling like, oh, this group of kids is basically has a different rule book, but it's functioning the same way as the normal kids. Like there's still these ways you're supposed to be and this really limited kind of path you can walk to be accepted in this community. And these are sort of to me like a distillation of like how you were supposed to be among the goth kids. Like Hot Topic, I think, is an example. Like, okay, now you're a goth kid. You go to this store and you buy these products and you wear them. And now you're part of this thing. And I don't think these were designed to be that, but these were sort of like the anthem of that community a little bit, you know, like, oh, this is a, or I don't know. They were just like another thing. To me, these are just like, I don't know what a, you know, 90210 or something, like just a popular thing that's sort of vapid that you're supposed to like, you know, I just don't like them. I hate these comics. I think that they're, I see some craft and like early Photoshop effects and stuff. Like I get what works
there's
about
like the
them.
Occasional gradient.
Oh yeah. Oh, really, really nice gray tones. His use of gray tones is like masterful. I will say this guy, but I just think that they're really, really tedious to read and I don't connect with them at all. Like, I just do not like these. And I'm not coming on here to like be a dick about it and criticize your opinions. I like when.
No. I mean, we can argue about it if you want. I respect your opinions. All right. So earlier today, I got real mad on Blue Sky about people, the perennial cartoonist bitching about Roy Lichtenstein.
Oh, okay.
Which I think is nonsense. Lichtenstein's fine.
Oh.
We can argue about that too.
I don't know. I didn't see this coming.
But yeah, I know it's out of left field, but what I realized was that I had to mute a lot of people who wanted to join the conversation, but whose opinions I don't respect and don't care about.
Oh, will you name them?
Yes, one by one. It's a long list. I hope you have time. But I would be happy to civilly disagree with you because I respect your opinion.
Well, thank you. That's and I'm
not going to mute you for it.
Thank you. Yes, that would be hard to get through the show if you muted me.
No, I mean, I think that might be a sign that you just had more sophisticated tastes than I did at that age, because it sounds like you were reading more comics than I was, and possibly had more, I don't know, Berkeley? That sounds sophisticated.
I mean, I'm rejecting the premise that I was more sophisticated than you is why. I think it's an aesthetics thing, you know. I think I just
I mean, because as an adult, if I was encountering these for the first time as an adult, I would be like, this is so stupid and so boring. But it's also partly because a lot of the things that Vasquez leans on for humor like the screaming and the random stuff,
mm-hmm.
that has become very, I think it's very oversaturated. It can oversaturated be intensified with a very, I don't know. I think that kind of like, oh, I'm gonna eat me some bacon kind of syntax.
Yeah.
I can't say that I ever really found it clever, but it definitely became grating sometime around like the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
but it was not grating to me yet.
Yeah.
Similarly, I've never been able to stomach Invader Zim. I can't fucking mm-hmm. cope. It's so boring and stupid to me.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever watched it. I mean, I know what it is. But...
My kid was into it for a minute. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, my kid's three, so I'm sure I've got some stuff coming.
Oh, see, my kid is 14, so mm-hmm. I showed him some of this comic, and I was like, you know, I was into this when I was your age. His reaction to it was kind of similar to when I showed him Ren and Stimpy.
Oh, which was what?
Which was also, I was into this when I was your age thing. Yeah. He was like, they were allowed to show this?
Yeah.
Why would anybody want to watch this? It's awful.
Oh, Ren and Stimpy was very formative for me. And I mean, those you do feel
yeah,
like,
but like, this was on Nickelodeon. I realize in retrospect, so much of it is like, I can't believe I'm watching this. I can't believe somebody is saying this and I'm seeing this.
Yeah, I mean, Ren and Stimpy also, though, had so many things that's like if you show a kid Pulp Fiction now, where you have to really go like, I show kids Pulp Fiction all the time. Where
you showed your three-year-old Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, where you go, they didn't do this in movies before this came out. You know, like this is real. Ren and Stimpy has all these, like SpongeBob SquarePants has taken a lot stylistically from Ren and Stimpy. There's just the close-up of like the highly rendered image of things, you know, like that's very, and like a lot of timing. So I don't know. No, I like that idea that this is of a time and like you as a teenager engage. I don't know. There's something I love about that.
Like,
it's
I
so
mean,
funny to me.
You know what I'm like now? Like I have probably what are considered more sophisticated tastes, I think.
I think of you as highly sophisticated. Yes.
Thank you. I think I have a reputation for that, for whatever that's worth, which maybe is part of why you found it so funny that I chose this comic.
Well, I connect with it too, because like I ended up doing nonfiction comics and, you know, I read like Todd McFarlane on Spider-Man was like my equivalent mm-hmm. to this for you, where I was just like, whoa. And it just like shaped my brain into a person that was obsessed with comics forever. And that's so far from anything I care about now, you know?
Yeah. It's not so much, is there something about the vibe that becomes like a through line? There's just little whiffs of it that you get on the air.
Well, and there's a gothiness to your comics. I'd say they're
sure. I think I have a very like goth sensibility, and 90s goth is its own thing. I mean, it's funny to see Jonan's depictions of himself,
mm-hmm.
which are also like a very skinny, weird haired goth guy with like glasses and again with the like all the buckles on the pants, and you know he is of that time also. It's again, it's like an artifact. It's not just a manufactured thing, but it's like it's from this specific person.
It's trend setting is what it is. Like there's a very genuine quality to these comics. I don't think he's trying to do anything. I think he's just
And part of what turns me off about Invader Zim, and even you see it a little bit in Squee and some of his later work, is that there's like a smoothness and a stylization. It becomes a little too slick for me.
Mm.
And I really like the ugly panels, the ones where the drawing is a little bit inept. There's a lot of weird little notes in the corners that say like, oh, I hate this panel. I have a headache. I'm very itchy. I want to go to bed.
Yeah. Or even like, here's a totally unrelated thing. I felt like drawing for one panel.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
His name is Boopy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's stupid, right? I get that you're groaning because you think it's stupid. I would never put that in one of my comics, but it's endearing because it is a missive from a real person in a real moment.
Yeah. No, I get it. I get it.
You're just over it.
Well, I'm a jerk. I'm a jerk is what's happening. No, I don't know. It's just a real specific angle where I can't. I mean, I was in a specific time and place too, like where this was just like a trending thing. And also this really did the thing, like the dream of comics is to break out of comics, right? Mm. Like people who bought this comic, it was the only comic they ever bought or read.
That's true of me at that time.
Yeah. So like if you're in high school and you're obsessed with comics and you work at the comic store, this is like a lot of people's frame of reference for what comics are, kind of, you know, like.
But OK, here's the thing. I'm describing I was 14, 15 years old when I was reading this. You were not 14 when you were working at a comic shop, were you?
I was. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, they would hire like a high school kid, and there was like a long succession of them at Comic Relief in Berkeley. And I used to go there on the weekends when I was like 12 and just read comics all weekend because they let you just sit in there and read. And there was a high school kid working there. I was like, what the hell? And that was like all I wanted in the world was to get that job. And I just like bugged the manager until he hired me. And I started in the summer.
I was working under the table until I was 16. I was not.
I was under the table for like a year, and I would do fill-ins and I would work like in the warehouse and stuff like that. And then I started working in going after school and working in the store, I think sophomore year. So I was 15, but I'd been working there under the table for like a couple of years at that point.
See, but I do think that speaks to your having more experience as a comics reader at that age, because I think even a couple of years later, 16, 17, I would have probably completely disavowed these comics. I would have been like, oh, that's kids stuff. It's so stupid. It's, you know, fucking Happy Noodle Boy. There's
Happy Noodle Boy. Yeah.
I was never really able to stomach Happy Noodle Boy. Happy Noodle Boy is a kind of side comic that's in universe written by Johnny the Homicidal Maniac. And it's like a stick figure, free association, like, you know, he's screaming like, suck my minty nutsack. I laid eggs in your head. I don't know. Like, just kind of saying random stuff. It's very like Purple Monkey Dishwasher.
Yeah.
But before that was a thing. Before a whole bunch of other people took this very unpalatable form of humor and ran with it and made it worse. I think some of these, this was like the first time I ever actually sat down and tried to read the Happy Noodle Boy ones, because I did kind of skip those as a kid because they make no sense and they're stupid.
Yeah.
And even as a very young person, I was kind of turned off by vulgarity. There's a kind of vulgarity that can be transcendental. I think what I'm really allergic to is feeling like somebody is trying to get a rise out of me. That I disengage. So Happy Noodle Boy was a turnoff for me. The side characters that I really like from Squee and the Joan and Vasquez expanded universe are, I like Wobbly Headed Bob.
All right.
Wobbly Headed Bob is sort of like a bear that has, I think he's a bear. He has a great big head because he has an enormous brain, and he goes around. He's like, he's miserable because he's smarter than everybody else. He can't relate to anybody, and everybody that he meets, he makes their lives worse. And I found that very relatable as a child, and I still do.
Okay. A lot to get into there. I don't know.
Sure. And then Filler Bunny is a very scribbled, like, cartoon bunny, obviously, who gets introduced to fill a page that had previously been filled with an ad that then became obsolete when they reprinted the comic.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a pagination problem, which all small press cartoonists are familiar with, I think. And the concept of Filler Bunny is that he was grown in a lab to amuse people, and they won't let him die. And when he gets tired, they inject him with stimulants, and then they sedate him until the next time that they need him to fill up a page. And again, it's a whole lot of like, life is torture. Please let me die. I'm in horrible pain for the entire time that you see me in this comic. I don't know. I was like severely depressed as a young teenager also. Maybe that's relevant.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely an angst to these. Like, it feels like if you're like a suburban.
Yeah, but it's a silly angst.
Yeah, well, that's part of the thing, right? If you're like a suburban misfit kid or whatever, and you feel like you don't belong. Like, I could see how this both hits your angst and relieves it in some way, too. Like, I see how this is like hitting the right button for a certain generation and a certain point of development for younger people.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that I read it so young and so untouched that the idea of Filler Bunny still like comes to me often. Like, say, if I have to get up at 5 to take my kid to school or something.
Yeah.
I think about like Filler Bunny getting like an injection in his eye because he has to like get scraped out of his cell to go and entertain the people.
Hmm.
That's true to my experience, I guess, what I'm trying to say. There's a lot of unhappiness being made light of. And I think that that is still an approach that works for me. I've always been, and we joke about this in my house, that the only kind of comedy that I like is the kind that makes you cry. You know the show Wundershowzen?
I don't think I've seen it, but I've heard of it. Well, just pretend like I do.
Sorry. Have you heard of this thing? Is never really a good way to start a conversation. But so Wundershowzen was a kind of artisanal show made by a small New York comedy troupe that ended up being on VH1 late at night, I think. In the early 2000s, which is where I saw it. It's very weird. It's grotesquely offensive. You sometimes see like gifs of it and memes and things. It survives. There's like a picture of a little kid dressed up as Hitler saying, "What's wrong with the youth of today?" The gif of the little kid yelling, "That's racist." That's from Wundershowzen. The reason that I bring it up is because Wundershowzen is one of my favorite shows because, again, it can be very painful to watch. And my favorite bit from Wundershowzen is one where the framing device of Wundershowzen is that it's a show for children. So there's like Muppets, you know, they're nasty Muppets that do gross things, but not quite so smug as, say, like an Avenue Q type of approach. So they have a science fair, and the girly puppet, the pink one, very self-aware, very tongue-in-cheek, her piece for the science fair is it's like a little propeller hat. She says, "I made a hat that's powered by sadness," and then she puts it on her head, and then the propeller starts spinning and she flies away.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole thing. And then later on in the show you see her again, and she's like, "Oh no, I'm running out of power." And then a seagull shows up and shows her all these horrible, like a picture of a clubbed baby seal and stuff. And she's like, "Oh, thanks." And then she takes off again. So humor that relies on something horrible or on the character being so sad that it's funny, I think is what tends to work for me.
Yeah,
and I think maybe there's a baby version of that in this.
Yeah, there's a little bit of like an Edward Gorey thing, I think, in this and in your stuff, too. And maybe I'm just talking about line weight or something, but I'd say there's a... I'd say Edward Gorey is the ancestor of yours and Joan Vasquez's comics, which again is maybe
a little bit
proto goth comics, but
people always refer to Edward Gorey. I feel like my stuff is not that cute, although Edward Gorey's work is sometimes much darker than like the Ghastly Crumb Tinies, which is the thing that people normally are familiar with.
To just like your line weight and your hatching, and there's just like I can see that part of
sure, a lot of Edward Gorey's stories are funny in a very sad way. One of my favorite ones is my all-time favorite Edward Gorey story, I'm gonna say now and realize later that I forgot something really important, it's called The Blue Aspic, and it's about a guy who is in love with an opera singer, and he has this kind of parasocial relationship with her. He's basically a stalker. So it talks about like the parallels of their lives. It basically, like, one page is about her and one page is about him. As her career takes off, like, his life becomes more and more horrible. He spends the last of his money on records. And then when he gets evicted from his apartment, like, he gets thrown out into the street and he's holding all the records in his arms and they all get smashed on the sidewalk. And, he dies in a gutter when she has her triumphant gala performance. And it is a tragedy. It's a tragedy. But it's a little bit funny also.
Yeah.
Is it funny?
I think so. I don't know. I don't know that one.
I think
one,
when you lean into that kind of tragedy unflinchingly, it becomes funny.
Well, and I think like the relentlessness, like that's part of the thing about these comics is sort of the relentlessness of them, of like, squeeze.
Yeah, that's
something.
Like the thing of the horrible, unwatchable movie is that it just continues to go deeper. Right.
Yeah. It just keeps.
It keeps being like, and then people think that they're finally free and it's over. But then.
Yeah. It just keeps
something worse
going.
And I love that. I love the ordeal, Caligula, Sallo. I love a movie that you're like, not sure if you can make it through.
Yeah. Yeah. I get it. It sort of stands in its own. It's its own subgenre. So endurance, that was what you said in the first place. So usually we go through issue by issue and the preamble is fairly short, but now we've been on the preamble for I don't keep track of time, but some time. Also, I feel like going through issue by issue is like, and then this bad thing happens to Squee, and then there's a happy noodle boy. So maybe we're just more talking about the general. I mean, if there's any like moments that stick out. Oh, one thing I noticed is there's an intro to each issue, and he has an AOL email address.
I didn't fucking read those.
Oh, he has an AOL email address, and you can email him. I think that's so.
Yeah.
And then by the end, the fourth issue, he has an Earthlink address. It's a big upgrade. I liked that. That was very like exactly of a time. But there's not. I don't know. I mean, some stand out more than others. The first issue, there's the aliens and two different aliens trying to abduct him, and. But yeah, they're mostly.
I think the
just
second
like,
two comics are stronger than the first two. I
in
will
the first
say
issue?
That I think the three and four are much stronger than one and two.
Okay, the first one has the Tickle Me Helmo, which is like a Tickle Me Elmo parody, and so
very
you think
of its time.
Very much. There's a lot of stuff in this where I don't know if it would make sense if you weren't kind of there at the, I mean, I think maybe this whole thing is,
right.
I'd be curious. You said you showed these comics to your kid, right?
I did.
And these probably seem incredibly
dated.
Impressed. Yeah. Yeah. The same response. As
yeah.
Me.
They seemed very silly and stupid to him. And I think that the explanation of, for example, Johnny the Homicidal Maniac that I gave to him was very similar to the one that I gave to you, because those tropes are incredibly familiar to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was like, oh, this is like this snarky, sarcastic serial killer who's like killing people, but they're stupid people. And he loves the Saw movies. So like he gets that.
But I imagine
and then, what do I say? Like, oh, but that was new and fresh then. Well, sort of.
Yeah, before you were born. I imagine these seem very dated. I can't see it, but I would imagine these are like watching an episode of Three's Company or something in a way, you know?
Yeah, probably.
So you're feeling like the last two issues are more polished than the first two?
I think I don't know about more polished. I think the quality is an improvement.
And they set up casts of characters too. Like there's Pepito, who's the son of the devil, who he makes friends with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, is issue three the one where he goes to dinner at Pepito's house?
Let me look. Yep.
Issue three has the terrible comic. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So I've got Dinner with Satan. This is on page 17 of issue three. At the bottom of the page, this panel right here, where he comes home and his dad says, don't expect us to feed you. You're going to your friend's house. And Squee is like, I don't have any friends except, who's this guy? What's his name? And his dad, without looking away from his computer, says Pepito. And Pepito, as we mentioned before, is the son of Satan and killed a bunch of kids at the school in a previous issue. This panel is really dynamic. It takes up the bottom half of the page. There's all these little tiny demons that are swarming in this kind of arch formation around Todd's head. There's a movement in it that's very dramatic, and I think unusually artistic for a lot of the drawings in these comics are just kind of like get the job done. This one is really working on a bunch of different levels. I think it's really neat.
I noticed too, I think he's a really good designer. Like there's a lot of, I think the page layouts are really good and the spotting of black on the page. And anytime it moves into design, like he's using gray tones I think he's a really strong designer.
I think the movement around the page, he doesn't use like there's a variation in the size and shape of the panels, but it's never difficult to figure out which panel comes next, which is actually really unusual. I think most cartoonists at this, like most small press cartoonists who are doing varied panel sizes have a really hard time. Like at some point you encounter a spot where you don't know how to move around the page.
Yeah, totally.
And that never happened to me with this. And I thought that was really impressive.
I thought there was one or two pages where it was a little unclear. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting that these are, I don't know. I would say too, like as we're moving towards the wrap up, there's a thing I've experienced a little bit with like things that are very popular where, you know, I think we all maybe hope for reaching a broader audience or whatever. This is one of those things where I was like, if this is popular, then I don't care to know what appeals to
people. You keep saying that. And like, for me, I didn't know anybody else who was into this. I think I met like one other person when I was like on summer vacation who had read this comic. And I was like, oh my God, we're like separated at birth. Like, I didn't know anybody else who liked it. But I didn't really have very many friends who were into comics at all.
Yeah.
I had like two friends who were also into anime. I had one friend who was also into indie comics, and she was into like more like the Max or Kabuki. Yeah, so my experience of these was not like there was no social aspect to it. I was not aware that they were popular.
Yeah, I think that these sold like hundreds of thousands.
I think if I had known that they were popular, I wouldn't have liked them as much.
That's like that's where I'm self-critical too, is but reading them now, I'm like,
yeah, I'm not proud of that, but that's definitely a tendency that I have.
Yeah, we all sort of reject things that are beloved by the masses. And there's a big theme of this, like, when there's a third or fourth issue, he's in school and it's like, you're all being brainwashed at school and programmed. And it's both kind of a genuine observation, and also feels like a very like forced counterculture view.
I know, but like, okay, so that starts out with the teacher saying, she asks him when Columbus discovered America, and he says 1492, and she says wrong, it was 1429.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, no, that's a typo, it was definitely 1492. And she's mm-hmm. like, well, you can't question the textbook, everybody knows that the textbook is always right. It sounds cliche, but I've had that experience so many times.
Yeah.
Like, I had that, God, I remember I had to do like vocational training when I was on welfare in Portland in maybe like 10 years ago. And there was like a typo on the quiz. And I was like, hey, like, maybe you want to know that this test you're giving us, like, there's a mistake in it. And the guy was just like, no, I think it's right. They do pretty good at checking those. And I was like, okay, so do you want me to put the wrong answer that's right or the right answer that's wrong?
Right.
And he was like, just do what the test says. Like, you're obviously a moron since you're sitting in the chair and I'm walking around looking at the people sitting in the chairs. Like, this is a thing that happens. And I it's well-trod ground, I'm sure, to talk about feeling like you're being bossed by people who don't know what they're talking about. But yeah, that was relevant to me then, and I probably wouldn't put it in such simplistic terms if I was going to write about it now. I would probably, you know, set it during World War II or something, but
that'll fix it. But no, there's a truth to it. I mean, there's a broad truth to it, which is where the appeal comes from. Yeah.
And it's funny, the idea that it would be so popular and then, like, you know, the whole point of it is like, oh, nobody understands me. That's always the joke about goth media, right? Is that all we do is complain about how different we are from everybody else, but we all do it together.
Yeah, totally.
Because we're all different in the same way.
Yeah. This is definitely like kind of a pre-internet world, though, too. Just like the so then the kind of the wrap up of the
yeah,
whole
he talks about getting fan mail, and it's mail. It's literal like folded up letters.
Yeah, and that, but so, and then it wraps up kind of cleverly where his parents send him to an asylum, and then Johnny the Homicidal Maniac's in there. It sort of like pulls it all together. Yeah.
I have to assume that there's a storyline in the Johnny comics where he ends up in the mental hospital. I don't know.
I read like the first one of those and then I never read any more. So I really don't know.
Oh, I think that part of the thing in Johnny was that there was he had like a wall that had to be painted with blood. And if he didn't paint it with blood, then demons would come through. Did I make that up? Or like something bad would happen if the wall wasn't constantly covered with blood?
Sounds vaguely familiar. I don't know.
If I made that up, that's really badass.
You're going to get some hate letters from adult goth kids. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure this was very frustrating from whoever stumbled on this who was a fan of Squee comics. But
I bet I could probably get away with ripping that off, actually.
You can.
I'll just say I came up with it.
Do an homage. I think you just figured out your next book. Are you working on a book right now?
I mean, yes, always. I'm working on a long-awaited anthology of all my mini comics. People are always asking for. There's a lot of people that don't like to buy a book that doesn't have a spine, so they're missing out on all these great comics that I only released as zines.
Mm-hmm.
There's a market for that. It is money on the table, which normally I'd like to leave money on the table and walk away.
Mm.
But in this case, the older my kids get, the more I feel obliged to provide for them.
I understand. Do you have a plan for that? Is Fantagraphics going to release it, or what's the story?
Yeah, it's going to come out from Fanta in the fall.
Oh, great. What's it called?
I don't know.
All right. Do you have any final words about these comics, these Squee comics?
I think it's interesting to come back to them because I think, as I mentioned before, I probably would have disavowed them as irredeemably gauche when I was an older teenager.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of like the music that I was into when I was younger, by the time that I was, you know, 17, I was going to art school and only reading very, very cool things and listening to indie music, and didn't, you know, it can be painful to look back on the things that you liked when you were still young and soft and impressionable. So it was a little painful to read this, but I think worth it. And I guess if I were to give advice to your listeners, if I may be so bold, I would say don't be scared to think about those early influences and what they gave you.
Yeah, it's fun. I'm going to go listen to some Rasputina after this because it's been...
Hell yeah. What's your favorite Rasputina song?
I like that cover of Brand New Key that they do. That's like an all-time great song to me, which I know is a cover. But and then Zoe Keating went on to do that like layered cellos album. That's just like incredible. Mm-hmm. That's so such great stuff. Well, before we wrap up, well, do you have anything else you want to plug or anything? Where can I find you online? You're on Blue Sky now.
I got my username for everything is Thorazos. I'm on Blue Sky and I'm on Patreon, Thorazos. You can subscribe and get a zine every time I make a new zine.
Ooh, who wouldn't do that? And then I have a question for you. Do you have a dream run? If you could do anything you want, would you do a new Squee series or...
I don't think I have anything to add to Squee. So I've been thinking about this, and the trouble is that I don't really have any, like, I don't, the comics that I like are mostly, they couldn't really be done by anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to imagine comics that I like being drawn by, say, me. So I'm still kind of stumped by it, and I'm so sorry.
I'm going to say The Incredible Hulk. Julia Grefera on The Incredible Hulk, a 12-issue run.
Sure. Yeah.
I think people have been waiting for that for a long time, so never too late. That's all I'm going to say.
I think I could do... The Incredible Hulk is kind of angsty, right? I'm really interested in, like, male angst.
There we go. Yeah, not enough male angst, I would say, in the world.
Or Swamp Thing. I think that's kind of a central theme of Swamp Thing.
I think you would make really cool Swamp Thing comics now that you say that.
Yeah, I love a swamp.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Can't go wrong with this. Okay, cool. Swamp Thing and or The Incredible Hulk. Or maybe it's a crossover between the two.
Yeah, pencil me in.
All right. I'll contact my agent.
Do that.
All right. Well, thanks so much for doing the show. This was a weird one because we usually go more specifically through the comics, but I feel like if you read one, you read them all. And it's nice to just talk broadly about these.
Okay.
So. I mean,
it was
comics.
A pleasure to talk to you. I'm sorry that you had to read such stupid comics.
Me too. But, you know, maybe we'll do it again sometime. Thanks so much for doing this.
Aren't you glad I didn't make you read Kabuki, though?
No, I would have rather read... I've never read Kabuki, but I feel like I probably would have preferred that.
Have you ever known, like, a white guy who only dates Asian girls?
I feel like I must have.
Well, just picture that guy in the comic that he would make if he was, like, really good at drawing.
Yeah, I know he's really... I've seen those covers, so I know he's...
Oh, they're beautiful. They're just insufferable.
Okay, well, maybe next season.
Maybe next time.
We'll talk about white guys who only date Asian girls. That really took a turn right at the end.
That's what it is.
I'll go into it knowing that. I'll look forward to it. Thanks so much for doing the show. And good
talking thank you for having me on. I'll talk to you later.
That was a fun one, even though I really hate those comics. I hope it's okay for people when I hate the comics. I feel a little weird about it, but gotta be honest. I don't pick the runs. It's fun to talk to Julia. I always wanted to have a chat that long with her. I feel like I should explain. We had some connection issues getting started, and we got this one's a little shorter because I ran out of time. It took a while to get going, but I don't know if you need to hear me say more negative stuff about Squeaky Comics. I also thought more about Rasputina afterwards. The new Zero, that's the other really good Rasputina song. I wish I'd asked her what her favorite Rasputina song was. That was very thoughtful of me. Anyway, it's super cool that you came on. Thanks for listening to the show. You can like and subscribe to us on all the good streaming platforms. You can stream the show on the Runs Podcast at blogspot.com. Subscribe, leave reviews, etc., etc. Put it on a website, social media. Let people know how good this show is. All right, thanks so much for listening, and hope to see you next time on The Runs.